Ex, Camillo said grimly. Police. Carabinieri. Felix froze, his bow in midair, his violin positioned for the swelling high point that would never come. Resignation shrouded Felix's features, and his hands fell to his sides even as his shoulders slumped. He set his violin carefully on the settee and placed the bow beside it. They all descended the stairs slowly, as if pulling against an invisible band that sought to draw them back to the security of the music room, to the safety of Paganini and Bach, to the comforting routine of long notes and scales. Three Italian policemen stood in the entry. Fabia had ushered them in and offered them refreshment. She never could get used to the fact that she wasn't supposed to open the door like hired help. She was no longer a domestic. She was the lady of the house, but no one could convince her of that. In her mind, nothing had changed. Camillo's maneuverings were just that, maneuverings. It was his home, and she was his housekeeper. Beloved, but still the housekeeper.
Felix Adler, one policeman asked briskly.
Yes, I am Felix Adler,
Uncle Felix replied wearily. He looked almost relieved, as if he had been anticipating the visit and was grateful not to wait any longer.
We have an order for your arrest.
I see.
Felix nodded slowly and clasped his hands behind his back, strangely docile. He was neither the fiery maestro nor the melancholy philosopher anymore.
But he is an Italian citizen.
Camillo was not resigned. He looked stricken, as if he had somehow failed again. Otto, and now Felix.
He is a foreign Jew. His citizenship was revoked with the 1938 laws.
The policeman showed Camillo his orders. It had all kinds of official-looking stamps on it. Italians loved their stamps.
But he received an exemption, Camillo insisted. It has been revoked as well.
The officer folded the paper and tucked it beneath his arm. Camillo reared back in shock, and angry color bloomed high on his cheeks.
When? Why?
The policeman ignored Camillo and addressed Felix once more.
You will come with us, please.
Where will you take him?
Camillo said, his voice shaking with outrage.
He will be detained for a time. Eventually he will be sent to Ferramonte or maybe Campania in Salerno, somewhere in the south. But he will stay in Italy.
Camillo asked helplessly. He looked at his brother-in-law, but Felix didn't comment. Felix's quiet acceptance was almost as unsettling as the arrest order.
Most likely. Don't worry. We are not like the Nazis. He will not be mistreated. We are at war, and this is for the security of Italy. That is all. It is simple internment. Nothing to be afraid of.
The Italian officer reassured them. He'd noticed Ava, and had puffed out his chest and smiled at her, as if she would possibly welcome the attention at such a time.
May I pack a small bag?
Felix asked politely. Ava could only stare at her uncle's blank face as he waited for an answer.
Yes, but quickly. There is not room or time to gather all your belongings. Your basic needs will be provided for.
Felix nodded agreeably and walked from the room. The officer trailed him, as if those being arrested had been known to make a run for it. But he stayed at the top of the staircase, dividing his attention between Ava and Felix's room. Felix had left his door ajar, and they could hear him moving about, opening and closing drawers, letting everyone know he was doing as he was told. When the gunshot came, it was oddly muffled, yet it reverberated through the house like a slammed door. For several stunned seconds, no one moved. The officer at the top of the stairs was the first to react, walking briskly to the room where his detainee had disappeared. They all stood, frozen, eyes lifted to the balcony overlooking the parlor, waiting for an explanation. Then they heard a shout and a string of Italian curses mixed with pleas to the Madonna. Camillo began to run, taking the stairs two at a time, a sight Eva had never seen before. Camillo Rosselli didn't run. His response had Eva racing up the circular steps behind him. But before she could enter Uncle Felix's room, her father turned and, with shaking hands, bade her to remain outside. "Wait, Eva," he commanded. "Let me go first." The carabiniere was suddenly back, his face pale, his upper lip shining with perspiration. He shut Felix's bedroom door behind him as if the matter were closed.
"He is dead," he said. "He has shot himself in the head."
His voice was matter-of-fact, but his throat worked like he was trying not to be sick. He shoved his black cap back on his head, avoiding Ava's gaze for the first time since he'd arrived at the villa. She immediately shoved past him and reached for the door, bursting through into the masculine space that smelled like shoe polish, coffee, and the soap Felix used when he shaved. But there was another smell. Blood. It smelled like blood and an acrid scent Eva would later come to recognize as gunpowder.
"Eva!"
Her father grabbed at her arm and pulled her back. But not before she saw the crimson pool that crawled like a living thing beneath the closet door and across the terrazzo floor. Felix Adler had stepped into his closet, closed the door, and calmly killed himself. As far as families were concerned, they definitely weren't typical. Angelo was sure most Jewish families didn't include a Catholic priest and his Catholic grandparents. But they were the only family Felix Adler had. Felix didn't have any parents left. He only had Santino and Fabia. He had no siblings, just Camillo, a brother-in-law. He wasn't married, and he didn't have children, though he'd treated Eva and Angelo as though they were his own. Thus, Camillo, Eva, Santino, Fabia, and Angelo gathered at the synagogue before the service, the five of them charged with the duty of Avilim, official mourners. Angelo had come from his little parish as soon as he received word, and Eva had fallen into his arms, the strain between them temporarily forgotten for a more immediate concern. They'd had no contact since his ordination. No letters, no telegrams, no friendly visits. It had been 7 months since he'd received his holy orders. 7 months since he'd been home. Now they stood side by side, Eva's arm wrapped around his as Rabbi Casuto offered what little explanation he could for something inexplicable. Eva herself had had little to say. She had not been far from Angelo's side since the moment he'd arrived, and though she clung to him, letting him know she needed him, she'd been silent. She even wept quietly, as if Felix had taken sound with him. The maestro was gone, and the music was too. Camillo wanted her to play at the service, but she just shook her head and he'd seemed to understand. He found another student of Felix's to play something by Mendelssohn, something Felix would have appreciated, and the matter was dropped. Before the service began, they ripped Felix's shirt, a ritual called kiria, or tearing, symbolizing their separation and the loss in the fabric of their family. He had been torn from them, and as each of them rent a piece of the garment, they recited the passage from the book of Job. "God has given, God has taken away. Blessed be the name of God." They would wear the strip of cloth attached to their clothing and would keep it there for the 7 days of Shiva. God had not taken Felix away. Felix had chosen to go. And though suicide was treated as seriously in Judaism as it was in Catholicism, there was no judgment. And Rabbi Casuto was the first to add, "Baruch atah Adonai, Dayan ha'amet." Blessed are you, Adonai, truthful judge. Felix was a casualty of war, Rabbi Casuto said. And that was the end of it. Angelo had conducted his first funeral a month before. A beloved mother and wife in his impoverished parish who'd died unexpectedly. He'd been terrified of failing the family in their time of need, but found that as long as he kept his focus on the deceased and on her loved ones, and stopped worrying about himself, he was fine. He'd conducted the funeral service in Latin, and Rabbi Casuto spoke in Hebrew. Eva had to translate what she knew. But the sentiments were mostly the same. We are made in his image, and to him we return. After the service, they'd joined the long procession to the gravesite, stopping 7 times as if to show the difficulty of the task, the pain of the ordeal. And when Felix's casket was eventually lowered into the ground, they shoveled dirt over his final resting place, committing him back to the earth. It was beautiful and painful, just like life, just like coming home, just like seeing Eva again. They went back to the villa and spent the rest of the day welcoming a steady stream of friends and neighbors, until eventually, just like the other rituals of the day, that too had come to an end. Now he sat next to Eva on a stool so low that his prosthetic stuck out in front of him, his eyes on the candle that had been lit the moment they returned and had been burning ever since. "What does Shiva mean?" he asked, wanting to pull her from the solitude of her silence. She was so withdrawn he was worried about her.
"It means 7,
she answered immediately.
"Ah, I see. We stopped 7 times today, and you will sit Shiva for a week. 7 days."
Strange.
It had been 7 months since he'd been home.
"Yes."
"Why is 7 significant?"
"It's from Job. When he lost everything, his friends sat with him for 7 days and 7 nights, grieving with him and for him."
They fell into silence once more, and Angelo was at a loss, sick at heart, helpless to the point of tears, frustrated that he couldn't hold her and make her laugh, that things between them couldn't be easy and comfortable, the way they once were. He fisted his hands in his hair and found himself confessing.
"I can't stay, Eva. I would like to, but I have responsibilities that can't wait."
"I know," she said softly. "Thank you for coming."
"I would take it away from you if I could.
I would take it with me.
I would take your pain and bear it for you."
He would happily endure her sorrow if it meant she wouldn't have to.
"I know,"
she said again, as if she truly believed him.
"I know you would. But sadly, that is not how pain works, is it? We can cause pain, but we can so seldom cure it."
"Talk to me. Maybe that will ease it. Tell me what all of this means."
He swept his hand around the room, including the candle and the covered mirrors, the low stools and the meal of condolence that the family had eaten. It had been a strange mix of eggs and bread and lentils, not the kind of comfort food he would have chosen.
"Tell me about the candle," he suggested, giving her a starting point.
"A member of the family lights the candle immediately upon entering the home. It's called the Shiva candle, and it burns for the entire 7 days."
Angelo nodded, encouraging her.
"The candle reminds us of the soul of the one who has gone, and also of God's light. After all, he created our souls with his light. It's from a psalm, I think."
"The light of God is the soul of man,"
Angelo quoted.
"Yes,"
Eva nodded.
"That's the one."
She stopped talking, a contemplative expression on her face, and Angelo pressed her, not wanting her to slip away again.
"And these stools?"
Eva looked startled, as if she'd forgotten he was there for a moment.
"Oh, well, we are closer to the ground, closer to the loved one who is now in the ground."
Symbolism. He was a Catholic priest,
If he understood anything, he understood symbolism. And the mirrors, he prodded. The mirrors were all shrouded in dark cloth.
Grieving is not a time to worry about appearances.
There should be no judgment in grief. People should be allowed to grieve in any way they need.
It is a kindness to the mourners. Shiva is about those left behind.
He reached over and took her hand in his, needing to give comfort. And they sat, staring at the flickering candle, holding hands across the space between their odd little stools.
I said Shiva after you were ordained,
Eva blurted out suddenly.
I didn't realize that was what I was doing, but for a week I didn't leave the house. I couldn't. I covered the mirror in my room so I wouldn't have to look at myself. And I slept on the floor. You left me behind and I was grieving.
She laughed hollowly and let go of his hand.
Angelo didn't know what to say, but somehow she'd given him some of her pain to bear,
because all at once his heart was heavy with shared sorrow. She had come to his ordination. She, Camillo, Felix, Santino, and Fabia. His family. He had wondered often about her impressions of that day. What had she thought as he lay prostrate on the floor, his arms folded beneath him, his forehead pressed to the ground, his eyes closed, letting the litany of the saints roll over him, through him?
Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy. Christe eleison, Christ have mercy. O God, make me worthy. Make me better. Help me to be a valiant servant. Help me to be more than I am.
He had silently prayed, wanting only to be better, to be worthy. Donatello's Saint George had risen in his mind and moisture had fallen from his eyes.
Help me slay my dragons, he had whispered. Help me resist the serpent. Help me resist. Help me. Help me.
O God, the Father of Heaven, have mercy upon us. O God, the Son, Redeemer of the world, have mercy upon us. O God, the Holy Ghost, have mercy upon us.
The voices around him had intoned. His hands were anointed and bound, consecrating them, sanctifying them, that whatsoever they blessed would in turn be blessed by God. The bishop had placed his hands upon his head, asking him if he could swear obedience. He had said yes. Yes to obedience. The bishop asked him if he could give his life to God and forsake personal wealth. He had said yes. Yes to poverty. And finally, he had said yes to celibacy, forsaking the pleasure of the flesh for the joys of the kingdom of God. He had said yes. He had promised his life and his heart and his loyalty. Yet still he had wondered. He had wondered if, as Eva watched, she felt the same stirrings that moved him whenever the Eucharist was raised and voices were lifted in worship. He wondered if she saw the beauty and understood. He had wanted so badly for her to understand. And he desperately needed to stop caring. She leaned toward him suddenly, and Angelo thought for a moment that she was reaching for his hand once more. Instead, she tugged on a loose thread hanging from the sleeve of his cassock and tore it free. She held the little string between her fingers, smoothing it over and over. When he left for Rome the next morning, the string from his cassock was tied around the piece of fabric from Felix's shirt and pinned to her blouse. In August, 2 months after Felix's death, Eva's father took her to the beach. A day trip, he called it. That's all they were allowed anymore, day trips. They couldn't stay at the resorts or rent a cottage. So they took the train from Florence to Viareggio, walked the 10 minutes from the train station, and kicked off their shoes and walked in the sand, pretending it was all the vacation they really needed. Camilo's ankles were skinny knobs sticking out below his rolled slacks. He took off his hat and let the breeze sift through his salt-and-pepper hair as the sun glinted off his spectacles. Ava shouldered their lunch and tucked her shoes inside the hamper so she wouldn't have to carry them. The beach was crowded, a forest of umbrellas and laughing children, and Ava longed for the beaches of Maremma, with stretches so isolated you could walk and never see another soul. Eventually, they found a place to sit and spread their lunch on a blanket, watching everything and nothing, trying to enjoy the change of scenery, if only for each other. The wind kicked up once, spraying them with sand and surf, and their lunch became decidedly crunchier.
"It's funny, isn't it?" Camilo said vaguely, his eyes on his feet.
"What's funny, Babbo?"
"There is sand in my sandwich and sand between my toes." He shook one foot and then the other, as if verifying that there was indeed sand between his toes.
"That isn't terribly funny," Ava teased.
"It is irritating me. Sand everywhere. In my food, in my clothes, rubbing against soft skin, every crack and crevice. I don't think I like eating on the beach. No matter what I do, I can't seem to avoid it."
His voice was thoughtful, like he was puzzling something out, solving a riddle. Ava just waited, accustomed to her father's roundabout way of expressing himself.
"But sand is my business. Sand, soda ash, and lime. Without sand, there wouldn't be glass. My father named the company Ostrica. Oyster, because the oyster takes the sand and makes it into something beautiful. Like we do. We take the sand and make it into glass."
"I didn't know that. Grandfather Rosselli was a romantic."
"We want to make the mundane beautiful. Isn't that right?" he asked.
Ava remembered the conversation she'd had with Angelo in the cemetery, when she'd explained what a mitzvah was.
"Everything is a mitzvah to you,"
she said softly, and wrapped her arm through Camillo's, her eyes on the horizon, her thoughts on Angelo and oysters. No matter how hard she tried, everything reminded her of Angelo.
"Not so. I am just an oyster hiding in my shell, turning sand into glass."
His voice was so melancholy, the ache beneath it so audible, that she pulled her eyes and thoughts back to his face.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm really no different from so many others, I suppose. I have been hoping it would all right itself."
"What?"
"The world, Ava. The terrible state of the world. I thought I could just juggle, strategize, bend myself and my circumstances around the laws. And I have. I've managed to keep the business afloat, keep our home, provide for you and Santino and Fabia. But the world isn't going to right itself. Italy isn't going to right herself. Not without help. I can't continue hoping and doing nothing. I can't continue hiding in my shell and making glass. I have to do more. We all have to do more. Or we will all die."
"Babbo."
She heard the alarm in her voice, and her father turned to her with sorrow-filled eyes.
"I have to go get your grandfather, Ava. I owe it to Felix."
"In Austria. But isn't he in a camp?"
"The Germans can't possibly want one old man. He won't be a good worker. I will buy his way out, trade something of value. It is what I am good at. I'm a natural-born salesman. You know that. I will get him and I will bring him here with us. Then Angelo will help us hide him until the war is over."
"How will you get him out?"
"Ava, Ostrica provides bottles to many wineries in Austria. I have been to Austria dozens of times, and I have every reason in the world to travel there for business. I am an Italian citizen, and my documents clearly show that. No one will question me. I have identity papers for Otto, claiming that he is also an Italian citizen.
How did you get false papers? She cried.
I have a very good printer at Ostrica. You remember Aldo Finzi? He makes labels for bottles, beautiful labels. And we have been making passes, Eva. We are making false papers for refugees. It is some of the best work Aldo has ever done. I didn't want to tell you. What you don't know can't hurt you.
Oh, Babbo, she moaned. If you get caught with Grandfather, they might arrest you both. They could take the factory if they discover you are forging documents there.
I do not own the factory, Camillo said lightly. How can they take it away?
Does Signore Sotelo know?
Gino Sotelo was her father's best friend and non-Jewish business partner.
Yes, Gino knows. And if something happens to me, I hope he will let Aldo continue his work. It is work that will save lives.
Her stomach rolled and her heart plummeted. She was worried about her father's life most of all, and what he was planning to do would put it in terrible danger. Eva didn't really believe her grandfather was still alive in Austria. He'd been arrested, taken away, and Uncle Felix had lost hope. Then they'd lost Felix, too. But they lost him incrementally, inch by inch, indignity by indignity, until there was nothing left when he finally pulled the trigger.
Don't worry, Eva. I will be fine, and I will bring Otto back. I can't leave him there. He cannot save himself. No Austrians are being allowed to leave anymore, especially Austrian Jews.
You can't go. Please don't go.
I have everything in order. I won't draw attention. I will be courteous and quiet, just like I always am. Invisible. And everything will go smoothly. You'll see.
If something happens to you, I will have no one left. No one, Eva cried, abandoning her courage for honesty. She couldn't let him go.
I will be fine. But no matter what happens to me, you will always have Angelo. He promised me. You will always have Angelo.
Her father's voice was fierce, as if he could make it so by sheer will.
Oh, Babbo, you don't understand. I will never have Angelo.
She looked out at the horizon, squinting in the sun, letting her eyes burn as she cried,
I don't have Angelo. I don't have Uncle Felix. And soon, I won't have you.
1943.
16 September, 1943. Confession. I never feel safe. Just last Wednesday, people were dancing in the streets, saying the war is over for Italy. Italy surrendered to America, and an armistice had been granted. Everyone said the Americans would be arriving soon, and our soldiers would be coming home. Some even said the racial laws would be revoked. But on Saturday, the Germans moved in and occupied Florence. They have taken control of everything north of Naples. The celebration is over, but the war is definitely not. The sites have just changed. We've had no word from Babbo. I try not to think about him at all because it hurts too much. Maybe I'm weak, but I've heard rumors about the labor camps. Some say they are death camps. And I'm afraid I'll never see Babbo again. So I put him out of my head completely, and I put one foot in front of the other. Forgive me, Babbo. Angelo is here. He's back. He says everything is going to get worse, not better. He thinks I need to go back with him to Rome. I don't know why he thinks Rome will be safer for me. The Americans bombed Rome in July, and so far no bombs have fallen in Florence. But he says he can hide me. He has been helping Jewish refugees since the war began.
Santino and Fabia will be alone, but Angelo says I only endanger them.
Santino and Fabia are afraid for me, and they begged me to go. They think Angelo can keep me safe.
They don't know that Angelo makes me feel things that aren't safe. He makes me reckless and angry. He makes me sad. And I know he doesn't feel safe with me.
Eva Rosselli. Chapter 7. The Villa. Angelo had made the trip from Rome to Florence 12 times in the last 18 months, and none of the visits were of a personal nature. He had a reason to visit his hometown, knew the city and its residents well, particularly those within church circles, and he spoke English, enough French to get by, passable German, and, of course, flawless Italian. He was young and handsome, drawing some attention wherever he went. But his black priest's robes, stiff white Roman collar, and his missing limb gave him an alibi that many Italian men did not enjoy. There were Jews hiding across Italy, but there were twice as many soldiers running for cover, trying to avoid being shot on sight or rounded up and sent to Germany to labor in work camps. Italy's surrender to the Americans on September 8th had put her citizens and her soldiers in an impossible situation. They were now Germany's enemies instead of her allies, and the Germans considered the soldiers, when they found them, prisoners of war. More than one young priest had been hassled by the Gestapo, and a few had found themselves in jail until someone could come and vouch for them. Angelo didn't have that trouble. He was exactly who he said he was, which made his movements a great deal easier. That morning, he had escorted a group of foreign refugees from Rome, just as he'd been instructed. He'd separated the 8 refugees on the train, so that if one was caught, the others might still have a chance. He'd told them all to pretend to sleep, so when they were asked for their documents, they could sleepily hand them over without speaking and giving themselves away. The trip took 6 hours, but the refugees had played their parts. It had all gone as smoothly as he had hoped. He'd escorted them from the Stazione di Santa Maria Novella, and from there to the nearby basilica with the same name. At the basilica, they were met by another priest who would take them on to Genoa. From Genoa, someone else would take them on, hopefully to safety. There were other refugees who were escorted into the Abruzzi, where smugglers and a local priest would bring them into Allied territory. Angelo didn't know who. None of them knew who was involved beyond their initial contact. It was safer that way. If one person was caught, they couldn't betray what they didn't know. It was a network of volunteers who were blind to all but their part. No real mastermind, no official organization, just desperate measures by willing people. And it worked only through the grace of God and the goodness and courage of each individual. But Angelo hadn't come to Florence just for the foreign refugees. Not this time. This time, Angelo was going home, and the visit was very personal. He'd known the trip was inevitable, that the day would come. He'd been watching and waiting. When Benito Mussolini was overthrown in July and General Badoglio took his place, Angelo had waited, holding his breath. Many thought the old laws would be repealed and all would be made right. That hadn't happened. When the Americans started dropping bombs on Rome and the San Lorenzo district was destroyed, he reconsidered, wondering if Florence wasn't the safer place to be. But when the armistice was announced and the German tanks rolled in and occupied Rome, he knew he couldn't wait any longer. The war had hurt Florence, aged the ageless city, and her head was bowed with long suffering like a widowed bride. Like in Rome, there were Germans everywhere. Long lines for rations, and the people didn't amble. They darted to and fro, as if rushing made them harder to hit, harder to see, harder to oppress. As a people, Italians were exuberant and effusive, and they didn't hurry. Italians meandered.
Not anymore. Now they scurried.
Angelo let himself in through the big gate. It wasn't locked. He would have to scold his grandfather. The days for open gates were long past. He walked across the silent courtyard of the place he had once called home, a place where he and Ava had played in the fountain and broken a few windows when he tried to teach her American baseball. He was pleased to see the villa looked the same. His grandparents had taken care of it. The flowers still bloomed in riotous color, and the walks were neatly swept with no debris or sign of the calamity that had gripped Italy in its fist. The heat had eased, and the September air was balmy and the skies a brilliant blue. The beauty made him uneasy, as if the mild weather and the soft breeze conspired with the Nazis to lure them into complacency. Angelo wondered if his grandparents' tender care of the palatial home would simply make it a bigger target. A property in the heart of the city, easily accessible. It rose up behind a high wall on a main thoroughfare. Beautiful, well-maintained, irresistible. Just like Ava and the wall she'd built around herself. But walls wouldn't be enough. It was time for her to hide. He had to convince her to leave Florence. Ava and maybe his grandparents, too. They would be better off out of the city, away from the property that could only bring them unwanted attention. Camillo had been gone for almost 3 years. 3 years, and no word whether he lived or died. The only word they'd learned was Auschwitz. It sounded like a sneeze, harmless. But when it was whispered among the fearful, it became something else. The Grim Reaper come to call. The Black Plague. There were only rumors, but the rumors were enough to make some Jews flee with nothing but the clothes on their backs, looking for a hiding place. It made others cower in their homes, hoping that the plague would somehow miss them, spare them, and pass over, as it had once, anciently. But so often it didn't. The wisest ones hid. Camillo Rosselli had not hidden. He'd been so confident his Italian citizenship would protect him. Camillo had been sent to Auschwitz. That was all they knew. Angelo raised the knocker and let it clatter against the burnished red door. His eyes fell to the right, to the place where the mezuzah had once hung. He remembered the day Camillo took it down. It was 1938, and his shoulders had been set, but tears streaked his face. He'd transferred the home from his name and given it to Santino and Fabia to protect it from the racial laws. When Angelo had asked him why he cried, he told him he was ashamed. "I remove it because of fear. A better man would fight for his God, but I am not that man. It shames me to say I am not that man." The door opened slowly, and Fabia peered out into the afternoon sun, shading her eyes and squinting up at him.
"Angelo,"
she gasped, dropping the hand that shaded her eyes so she could clap her own cheeks and then his. She pulled him forward by the face, her arms stretched to reach him. She was even smaller than he remembered. Or maybe he had grown.
"Angelo, my beautiful boy, Santino, look who's here!"
Fabia called over her shoulder into the dim foyer, its cool expanse drawing Angelo's eyes. But it wasn't rest and refreshment or even his grandfather Angelo sought, but Ava.
"You are so big!"
his nonna exclaimed, drawing his eyes back to her wrinkled face.
"So handsome, mamma mia! You look like your father."
Fabia promptly burst into tears, which hadn't changed. She couldn't talk about her Angelino, his father, without crying. It had been so long since she'd seen him. Angelo suspected they would never see him again. The thought bothered him more for his grandparents than for himself. His grandfather tottered from the back of the house on bowed legs, clapping and calling Angelo's name. His white hair was unchanged, thick and waving back from his sun-browned skin. His blue eyes, the eyes Angelo saw staring back at him from the mirror each day, were bright and relieved.
"You came home. You came home, Angelo. Tell us you can stay a while. We have missed you."
Angelo kissed Santino's cheeks and bent to hold him close. Unlike his eyes, Angelo's height was not something he'd inherited from his nonno. When he straightened and stepped back, his gaze moved to the figure descending the wide marble staircase that rose grandly from the formal entry. Eva wore a dress of deep blue that made her skin look like cream, pale and smooth against the sapphire hue. She was thinner, and her dark hair was shorter, brushing her shoulders in smooth curls, as was the fashion. She used to wear it longer. Maybe age had made her more aware and careful, more mindful of the opinions and attention of others. He hoped so. It would make her safer. Eva greeted him with a soft hello, her lack of enthusiasm contrasting noticeably with Fabia's tears and Santino's clapping. He greeted her just as soberly, wishing he could embrace her like a sister, wishing he could convince himself that was all she was, all she would ever be. His eyes clung to hers briefly, looking for forgiveness and finding none. Eva's eyes were guarded. She was young, only 23 years old, but she wore the same vibrating tension he had observed on so many others he had helped and sheltered throughout the last few years, and it made her seem much older than she was. But she was still the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen. She reached the last stair and approached him, holding out her hands. He clasped one of hers in both of his.
"Is that how it's done?" she asked softly. "Is that a priestly greeting?"
He felt a flash of anger at her mocking tone and immediately rose to the bait, pulling her into his arms and embracing her tightly, albeit briefly. He felt her jerk, as if she hadn't expected the contact, and her gasp tickled his neck before he stepped back from her. She still smelled like the jasmine that Fabia grew in pots beneath the windows. It mingled with a subtle hint of something new, as if the sadness she wore gave off a scent of its own. Her grief had grown stronger since he'd seen her last. But then life had delivered some heavy blows, and Eva had absorbed them all. Her jasmine-scented sadness was justified. It had been too long. He should have come back sooner. But he'd been trying to move on. He'd been trying to let her move on. He wondered if they would have to start over from the very beginning. And if they did, would they manage to find common ground? A place where a Catholic boy and a Jewish girl could be friends, even family once again? There'd been a time when she would have followed him anywhere. He wasn't sure she would follow him across the street anymore. But he was going to do his best to convince her. The evening meal was meager. Nothing was plentiful in wartime. But Eva brought out a bottle of her father's Austrian wine, and there was laughter and reminiscence, even if it was flavored with forced levity. Eva participated, but her quick smile had slowed considerably, weighted down by strain. In fact, it wasn't present at all. The sparkle in her lustrous eyes was more nervous than mischievous, and there was a wary tilt to her head, as if she were listening for calamity to strike. Eva had always been grace in motion, as if the music she created on her violin was just beneath her skin. Now there was a stillness in her posture, as if she were poised to bolt. He hated it, and his own tension increased considerably. There was talk of what came next. Fabia was sure the old racial laws, the laws inspired by Mussolini's desire to placate Hitler, would be revoked now that Mussolini had been toppled and Germany was no longer Italy's partner in the war.
"It's going to get worse for a while, Nonna,"
Angelo said softly.
"Worse?"
Fabia cried, likely thinking of the losses Eva had suffered. The food shortages, The deaths of thousands of Italian young men on the Russian front and in North Africa. All for a war and an ideology most of the country didn't support.
You have to come back with me, Eva. To Rome. That's why I've come.
Angelo turned to Eva, ignoring the stunned faces of his grandparents.
Rome will be no safer than Florence,
Eva protested immediately.
It's farther south, closer to the Allied line, and no one knows you in Rome. You have false papers, yes?
She didn't answer. She just stared, probably wondering what he knew and how he knew it.
A false identity card won't do you any good here, Eva,
he continued, as if she'd given him an answer.
Too many people know you. Too many people know you are Jewish. Your papers will actually get you in more trouble. That's what got your father in trouble. He was recognized using false papers. You use them and they will torture you until you tell them where you got them. Until you give up Aldo Finzi and Gino Sotello and Nonno and Nonna too.
Three pairs of eyes widened, and Ava's chair shot back from the table.
How did you know about Aldo Finzi and Signore Sotello?
I know all about them. They've been helping us for years. And I know all about what you've been doing, too.
Us?
Eva asked sharply.
The church,
Angelo answered, unwilling to mention names, partly because he knew so few of them, partly because by not naming them they were safer. To give the whole church credit or blame was disingenuous. He'd seen many pastors and parishioners who'd needed their arms twisted and their salvations threatened. But there were many who helped, in whatever way they could, opening their doors, their cellars, and their hearts to one refugee after another. He'd witnessed nuns opening cloisters that hadn't been breached by a man, any man, ever. Jewish children were hidden in Catholic schools. Jewish mothers were wearing Catholic veils, and Jewish men were becoming monks, albeit temporarily, and learning Catholic prayers in order to stay alive, and no one was trying to convert them.
Do you really think my friends and my neighbors will run to the fascisti and give me up? I know many of the local police. Some of them are even friendly. They are Italians first, fascists second. And most of them hate the Germans.
But the Germans are in charge now, not the local carabinieri. And what about when they offer lire for the betrayal? When they start offering 3,000 lire for every Jew? How desperate are your friends? How desperate are your neighbors? Someone will turn you in, Eva. I've seen it happen. Some Italians even think that the sooner all the Jews are found, the sooner all this will end. Give the Germans what they want, so they will leave. That's what some believe.
Santino and Fabia jumped in then, trying to soothe Eva, trying to placate Angelo, trying to talk their way out of the threat they didn't want to face. It was so much easier to hope it was all going to get better. Angelo knew it wouldn't. The subject was dropped for the sake of peace, and they all eventually retired to their separate quarters. Angelo back to his old room at the rear of the house, the servants' quarters, though he'd never been a servant. There were times he had wished his presence in that house were that clearly defined, that simple to explain or justify. He paced his room and finally forced himself to kneel before the old cross Nonno had hung on his wall to say his prayers. It was the hour of Compline, an hour that should be spent filled with praise and gratitude. But Angelo found himself veering away from praise and reciting the psalms of entreaty.
Make me know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all the day.
Since becoming the pastor of a tiny parish at 22 years old, he had been begging God for direction on an hourly basis. It was a never-ending chant in his head. He didn't see that changing any time soon. When he was finished, he stood and scrubbed at his face, feeling renewed. He washed his hands and calmed his breathing, and then left his room, slipping through the halls and mounting the stairs, determined to resume his campaign. He was not leaving Florence without Ava. She answered his knock as if she'd been expecting him, and Angelo breathed a silent prayer of relief that she hadn't changed for bed. He didn't need to see Ava in a flowing dressing gown, regardless of how much it covered. She immediately retreated to the window overlooking the gardens Santino tended so carefully, the tennis court where she'd regularly trounced Angelo. In the moonlit darkness that was, to Angelo, menacing in its tranquility. It made his stomach feel hollow and his palms itch, as if the Gestapo stood in the shadowed corners of the yard and aimed their guns at the beautiful girl limned in gold and framed perfectly in the window. He walked to her and pulled her back, drawing the heavy drapes. She looked at him with eyebrows raised and didn't protest, but she immediately left his side, retreating to the opposite side of her room.
"You told me once that you believed in me. Please believe me now. The things I've been told, Ava, the brutality I've witnessed, the soldiers who have made it back to Italy have seen the camps. They've seen the trains overflowing with Jews, train after train. And the refugees have stories. None of it is propaganda. People don't want to believe, Ava, but I need you to listen. I need you to believe me again."
"When did I say that? 1938. 5 years ago I believed in you. Now I believe in nothing. I will stay in Florence with Fabia and Santino, and I will do my best not to die or be arrested and sent off to a camp. Okay? You can go back to Rome and your church and continue being Padre Bianco with a clear conscience. You tried. I refused. End of story."
"Madre di Dio!"
Angelo cursed beneath his breath, and then immediately berated himself, turning the curse into a silent prayer. "Madonna, please. Mother of Jesus, help me control my temper and save this girl." He added a plea to his own mother and to Ava's mother, Adele, on the off chance that Jews and Catholics all went to the same heaven. The longer he remained on this earth, the more he was sure that mankind had no clue about God or heaven. Not when they used him as an excuse to kill, to punish, to discriminate. He loved God. He felt God's love in return. But he felt no special claim to that love simply because he'd been raised a Catholic, simply because he was a priest.
"I have work to do here, Angelo. If you know what I've been doing, as you claim, then you know I can't leave."
"What does your rabbi say?"
He had her there. He knew exactly what her rabbi said. Rabbi Casuto had already hidden his wife and children in a convent. Angelo had helped arrange it. Soon the rabbi would go into hiding, too. The Delasem offices the rabbi helped run were closed. All the Jewish aid from the organization would go completely underground from this point on. Ava just looked at him, her throat working.
"I can't just hide, Angelo," she whispered.
"I will help you. I will hide you."
"That's not what I mean. If I go to Rome, you have to let me do what I can. I want to help. I want to do what you're doing."
He insisted, but he could hear her weakening. He didn't let the relief he felt show in his face. He really hadn't thought he would be able to convince her.
"You're not in a position to do what I'm doing," he confessed.
"But if there is a way for you to help, I promise, I will tell you." "Why do you care, Angelo? Really?"
she asked quietly. Angelo blanched and stepped back, as if Ava had walked across her bedroom and slapped his face. His cheeks stung like she had. Ava's expression was stony, her eyes black as she stared him down, her arms folded across her chest.
"That's a stupid thing to say, Ava."
He sounded like the boy he'd been, and hated that he was Angelo in this house and not Padre Bianco, ever patient and inflappable.
Is it? You've gone out of your way to make me feel invisible. I don't exist to you, Angelo. I'm a Jew.
Hitler doesn't want me to exist at all.
Remember.
For a moment, they both remembered. Too well. But it had absolutely nothing to do with her being Jewish, and she knew it. Angelo's breath grew labored as the vice that was Ava became impossibly tight around his heart. Ava was the vice. And the vice. That's what she'd become for him. And he couldn't deny it.
17 September, 1943. Confession. I'm going to Rome with Angelo. I don't know what else to do. It's too quiet and everyone is nervous, waiting. Rabbi Casuto is urging everyone to leave their homes and hide. He says there are reports of fascist fanatics, militarized squads, rounding up Jews and anti-fascists, and no one is stopping them. The Germans have deported thousands of Jews from Nice in France, Jews who had been protected by the Italian army, an army that is now disbanded. Rabbi Casuto says the Germans won't leave Italy, and now that we are not on the same side, they won't respect our laws or citizenship. The Italian government can't protect us anymore, even if they wanted to. No one can. Uncle Augusto, Aunt Bianca, Claudia and Levi are in Rome already. Levi is studying law at the Pontificium Institutum Utriusque Iuris, the only university that will allow Jewish students. Uncle Augusto seems to think the Vatican will be able to protect the Jews in Rome. But Uncle Augusto hasn't been right yet. Eva Rosselli.
Chapter 8. Rome. Eva and Angelo boarded the train early, and Santino and Fabia saw them off, their lined faces wreathed in encouraging smiles, even as their eyes worried. The platform was crowded with the normal bustle and cluster of people preparing for a journey, people disembarking while others jostled to get aboard. All around them, passengers were hurrying, Germans were watching, and whistles kept blowing, making them rush through their goodbyes and raise their voices to be heard over the din. The four of them pressed together, arms linked, heads bent to hear last words and expressions of love.
Take care of her, Angelo.
Eva heard Nonno say as he patted Angelo's lean cheeks. Angelo kissed Santino's forehead and embraced him tightly.
Remember what I told you, Nonno. No resistance. If the Germans show up at your door, give them what they want. You need only to worry about yourselves. Camillo wouldn't want you and Nonna to be harmed protecting his possessions. The only thing he would care about is Eva. And I will keep her safe. I promise.
Strangely enough, Fabia didn't cry. She looked too frightened to cry, and her little hands shook and her smile wobbled. And Eva resisted the urge to tell Angelo she had changed her mind, gripped by a sudden, terrible premonition that this was the last time she would see Santino and Fabia, that they would be whisked into the ether the way her father and Uncle Felix had, never to be seen or heard from again. Her panic must have shown because Fabia grabbed her hands, and the fear in her face was replaced with stern affection.
We love you, Eva. She said firmly. We have lived good lives. We have been happy. Don't worry about us. We have each other, and we will be fine. Some day the war will be over, and we will be together again. And you will play for me, yes?
Yes,
Eva whispered, unable to hold back her tears. Fabia hugged her close and spoke into her ear.
God sees you, Eva. He sees Angelo, too, and he is a loving God.
Eva embraced Fabia tightly, but her mind resisted the sentiments. Either God saw everyone or he saw no one. Too many were crying out for him to see them with no response. Angelo touched her arm and picked up her heavy suitcase, setting his own small bag atop it, gripping it beneath his arm as he leaned into his cane and allowed his tiny nose